Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It has been said that there are only two things certain in life, death and taxes. So let's talk about those things, specifically the religious and economic institutions that developed around the funeral service trade in the late antiquity period, straddling the pre-Constantine and post-Constantine eras of the Roman Empire. We have noted in previous podcasts that Emperor Constantine was crucial in shaping the history of Christianity, moving the church from an often persecuted faith to one of favored state status. How this major turn of events played out for the institutional church can be examined with respect to how funeral services were managed over time, with a noticeable increase in the corruption associated with the death industry coming after Constantine in the 4th century. This corruption was often associated with certain tax exemptions for privileged funeral workers, among other things. Ah yes, that age-old connection between death and taxes. Well, to help us sort all of this stuff out, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Sarah Bond, an assistant professor of history at Marquette University. I should note that I am an alumnus of the history department at Marquette, ring out Ahoya, so our conversation today will be just like going back to school, as if I ever left. Professor Bond received her PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill back in 2011 and is currently working on a book manuscript tentatively entitled Trade and Taboo, Disreputable Professions in the Roman Mediterranean. Sarah, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Disreputable professions, eh? Would that include funeral workers?
I guess it would, at least in the earlier time period. I guess that's up for debate as we work into the period of late antiquity, whether we think that funeral workers, at least for a brief period of time, were rather a bit more celebrated than they previously had been and would be in the future.
This is one of those jobs that you think about, well, you don't think about very much, right? You go visit crypts and tombs and tour cemeteries, and you may be driving past them and see them on the side of the road and such, and you never think about, well, somebody had to dig the hole and bury the person, or even, you know, drag the person out of their home or the hospital where they died and inter them. It's not one of those jobs we think about very much. In fact, it's one of those jobs you say, ooh, who would ever want that job?
Right. I mean, I think that probably in terms of our literary familiarity with most people who've read Shakespeare's Hamlet will remember that there are two grave diggers that are digging the grave for Ophelia and talking about how she had committed suicide and what should be done with her body, etc. But Shakespeare is manipulating the grave diggers to be rather base figures that aren't altogether very knowledgeable, and they're very desensitized towards death. And this is kind of the view of funeral workers throughout at least Western society and in many parts of the other parts of the world as well, that gravediggers are seen as kind of lower-level people that don't understand the gravitas of death, have become desensitized to it, and who in the world would want to touch dead bodies? That's kind of the general consensus of what the mortuary trade entails. But in fact, funeral workers are very, very important people even to this day, and they're largely invisible. We largely don't see them in society, and that's because we don't want to see them.
Yeah, I mean, dead bodies don't bury themselves, and it's one of these things you think about. Yes, you never see those people in action, but again, they're very, very critical. And you're right, they have a certain type of ethos associated with them that maybe not be all that favorable. I want to come back to this at the end of the podcast discussion, talk a little bit about the manuscript you're working on, but just give us a little flavor for what other disreputable reputations or disreputable professions, I should say, you are interested in.
Sure. I mean, the book is kind of organized into various different case studies into certain professions. So one chapter is on funeral workers and the ideas of tactility that are involved with touching corpses. But then other chapters are also kind of related to the senses, but not directly about it. So there's a chapter, for instance, on tanners. Tanners are people that touch dead bodies. They just happen to be the bodies of animals, and they strip animals of their fur and of their hides and then make leather. And they're also extremely important people in a society that does not yet have cotton, in a society that uses leather for many, many things, even though we often don't think about it because it doesn't survive in the archaeological record as well as materials such as stone. So tanners, there's an entire chapter on Prycones, who are criers, town criers.
Town criers?
Yeah, criers in the earlier empire, in the late Republic, in the early Roman Empire, have something called infamia, which is a stigma of disrepute that makes you kind of legally disreputable and gives you some civil inabilities, much like, say, convicted felons. Infamia is a stigma that you carry with you legally, and it shifts over time somewhat, but it's basically meant to keep people from attaining certain positions and certain rights within society if they engage in a disreputable trade. So there's lots of disreputable people, but not always the people that you would think are disreputable in the book. I mean, because ideas of disrepute change over time and are often reflective of the anxieties and fears of the society within which disrepute is created.
That is true, and one of those with a lot of fear and anxiety is the death industry of what happens when people die. And I have to ask, how did you ever get into this topic? As a graduate student, you're just sitting around and say, "Hey, I think I'll study the history of people who put people into the ground." It seems like a out of the blue kind of topic.
It does, but I kind of started thinking about collegia, and collegia is where we get the modern word college from, but it's a collegium in the singular, is just a voluntary association, and many times people equate this with, say, a medieval guild or a modern labor union. I was thinking about collegia, and I was thinking about people who were not very reputable collegia that populated collegia for the lower classes. And I found that there had been a lot of work done on people who populated kind of more upper-class collegia, like, say, ones that were created for carpenters or textile workers, but there hadn't been a lot of work done on collegia of, say, gladiators or people that had been seen as kind of infamous and unseemly within society. And I didn't find gladiators to be all that fruitful because there had been an incredible amount done and very well done on gladiators. But I had read and very much respect, and actually, let me be forthcoming, that I work with John Bodell at the U.S. Epigraphy Project at Brown University. And John Bodell is the world's expert on funeral workers in the Republic and early empire. So as I started looking at the voluntary associations for mortuary workers in the earlier period and trying to sort out how they formed voluntary associations, I just kept following the breadcrumbs and kept following the trail. And I found that a lot of people kind of left off when they got to late antiquity and were scared to kind of connect the dots between the empire and this later period, because we, as Roman historians, are often very specialized into certain time periods. I'm a Republican historian. I'm a early empire. I'm late empire. And so I kind of wanted to bridge the gap between the empire and late antiquity for these workers. It was really just I stumbled on this without really knowing what was going to happen, and then it was kind of a eureka moment that I was going to work on them.
Those are the best kind of dissertations. They just, you're following breadcrumbs, as you say, and then all of a sudden, hey, something's kind of odd here. Nobody's looked at this kind of thing, and well, we forgot about these people, and oh yeah, there must be people who do this in society, so we should definitely study them. We're working off an article that you have entitled Mortuary Workers, the Church, and the Funeral Trade in Late Antiquity, and I'm going to feel dumb for asking this, and I'm a little bit worried that you might rescind my history degree from Marquette, but what is late antiquity? What era are we talking about here?
Sure. Well, this is a modern construct. I mean, I don't think if you went back in time and asked the Romans specifically, hey, what period are you living in? They'd say, oh, well, this is late antique Rome. I mean, this is obviously something that we've constructed in the modern period to help us identify a certain time span. But really, the person that has most defined this period is a Princeton professor, now emeritus, named Peter Brown. Peter Brown is kind of our pater familias within late antiquity, kind of the head of a big field of study that opened up since the late 1960s into the 1970s, and has continued to flourish since then. That spans, well, I say about the middle of the 3rd century CE to the death of Justinian in 565 CE. But people will define it differently. Some people would say that it starts in, say, 313 with the Edict of Milan, or some people will say that it starts with the death of Constantine in 337. So it's still a little bit up for grabs in being defined, but it is marking a distinction between a period of stability and a period economically and socially that was a bit different than what we call the later empire or late antique empire, which is to say a bit more hectic, a lot of political overturning, a lot more economic turmoil, although not everywhere. So a lot of people sometimes get anxiety when they get especially into the 3rd century because of how much perceived craziness is going on, you kind of have to not be scared of how much is happening and just forge through and try and make sense of it.
So you're defining this middle of the 3rd century to about the middle later part of the 6th century, you know, give or take some decades. And one of the things that occurs during this period of time is the rise of Emperor Constantine, and specifically given that we are a podcast on religion, we're concerned about his conversion to Christianity and his subsequent declaration, the Edict of Milan, that Christianity should be put on an equal footing with other Roman, namely pagan religions. While I understand that the Edict of Milan did not make Christianity an official state church, it certainly does alter the religious landscape. So as a historian of this period and somebody who's focused on the workings of the church and its interaction with the state, give us your take on the Edict of Milan. What does this change?
Right. Well, first off, I want to say that somebody who doesn't get a lot of shout-outs that probably should is Licinius, who is doing this in conjunction with Constantine, because Constantine is the emperor of the western part, while Licinius is the emperor of the eastern part. And they come together in Milan in try to decide in 313 how they're going to proceed. And there had already been kind of a consensus that the great persecution of Diocletian had been ineffective and should be done away with in large part. And they decide that they are going to make Christianity licit. Of course, Constantine is probably a little bit more for this shift because of the events that happened at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312. He certainly wants to make Christianity not only licit, but to return back all the property and all the things that had been confiscated from the church during the periods of persecution that really had intensified under the Emperor Diocletian. I think that Constantine wants to patronize, wants to encourage Christianity as a patronus, as a patron, by endowing churches, especially in the city of Rome and elsewhere, and by being nominally a Christian, but in many ways Constantine continues to act as a quote-unquote regular pagan or polytheistic Roman would. I mean, in many ways he does not remind us of a traditional Christian the way that we think of today in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Constantine encourages Christianity, he begins to build churches, he begins to return their lands and to focus on Christianity as a religion and to make it licit and to also make it exceptional, does not himself always adopt, especially not in his earlier career, many of the Christian characteristics that we identify as being singularly Christian.
How did the Christian church react to this? Because prior to Constantine's and Licentius's declaration, the church was somewhat scattered, and it was in different parts. It was in North Africa, it was in the eastern parts of the Mediterranean, and even extending far out to the east. How did the Christian church react to this at the time? Were they pretty, you're not going to beat us up, and oh, thank you for purchasing churches, buildings for us. They got to have been pretty happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, right, when we speak about the church with a big C, we are kind of inferring that it's a monolithic institution by this time, which of course it's not. It's very fragmented. It's more little C churches that are throughout the Mediterranean, even though they have and did come together and have synods and meetings and decide on things in smaller proportions, and there were certainly clerics. There was a big support for Constantine and a hope that he was going to continue with his Christian faith, and we really see this in the early Christian writings of the time, especially through the ecclesiastical history of a man named Eusebius of Caesarea, who's a bishop, who writes glowingly very early on about Constantine and his conversion. There's certainly a hope among the clerics that he begins to give special dispensations to and favor, that they are going to be able to not only rebuild the church, but to really grow the church, proselytize, and have the Christian congregation swell. I mean, it's a great amount of hope in 313, and this hope continues on until Constantine's death in 337, which is really to be, can really show us why Christianity grew at such a high pace between those 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. When you get special dispensations and people are not persecuting you, and when you also have church buildings that are being built for you, that's got to be a pretty cool thing. One of the other things that occurs during this period of time, and we mentioned the fragmented church, is that the church needs to unify itself a little bit more. And there was something that was called the First Council of Nicaea that was called out there in what would be southern Turkey, I guess, today. And what goes on during here? Because I think that this was a very crucial period for church-state relations, and I want to get your take on that.
I mean, I completely agree. I mean, today, actually, the day that we are speaking is a remembrance of a synod held at the Lateran Palace to decide whether Donatus was going to be excommunicated or not. So we know, for instance, that people had gotten together within the church prior to Constantine, but Constantine, as a Roman emperor does, likes to get together concilia, that is to get groups that are going to confer and advise about things. Emperors consistently do this. And he calls one of these specifically for bishops and clerics to come together at the Council of Nicaea and to decide not only on something that had been kind of plaguing the church, that is to say, the nature of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, but also to talk about this guy that was instigating what many believe to be was a heresy, a guy named Arius, A-R-I-U-S, not to be kind of confused with Arians later on and Nazis in World War II. When they come together at the Council of Nicaea, they not all of them agree, but they vote on and determine the nature of the Trinity, that there is a common homoiousios, that is to say, the common substance that all three share, and that Arius, because he is not a believer in this type of Trinity, is in fact heretical and infamous. So it's going to take a while, and there's going to be some shifts back and forth on Arianism, but you can see that the Ecumenical Council is one key way that people are going to decide who is in and who is out, who is heretical and who is orthodox. And that's very important, setting the standard moving forward in terms of the utilization of ecumenical councils.
Yeah, this I can see this as well from the side of the empire or of the state, in that they, if they're going to give special dispensations to people, and if they're going to build churches for specific people, you need to know who those specific people are. So it was basically a calling of, let's get our act together, let's create one holy and apostolic church, not a bunch of them, so that we know how to deal with these folks, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And, I mean, it's a show of unity that's necessary, but it's also important to remember that Constantine is present and very much a very visible figure at the Ecumenical Council. I mean, there's no yet sense of a pope. That's not, he may be called Papa, but he is not yet the pope, as we would consider it, is together a grouping of bishops and Constantine as well. So it's a little bit different than later ecumenical councils in terms of character, because there's a secular presence very visible there.
Yeah, trying to get everybody together so they can give them those special dispensations, which leads us to our main topic today, which is the business of death and the special dispensations that come about in the post-Constantine era. Death happens. And humans have ways of dealing with death, everything from dumping the body out in the woods and letting it get eaten by wolves to having elaborate funeral processions and monumental burials, and you could think of everything in between there. But what is important is that this is an activity where somebody has to be employed to manage these things, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast here. Either somebody has to drag the body into the woods or to work the funeral arrangements about digging the grave and building the mausoleum and all that kind of stuff. So give us an idea briefly of how funerals or how the dead were handled in the pre-Constantinian era, either with respect to the Christian church or, if you're familiar with it, with respect to pagans or Jews or anybody else there. How was death managed prior to the Edict of Milan?
Sure. Well, we have two laws in particular that tell us a great deal about what happened in especially the late Republic and early Empire. So this is about the 1st century BCE to the 1st and 2nd century CE. These two laws come from a town named Puteoli and Cumi, and they tell us that essentially funeral workers were supposed to live outside the walls of the city. Death was supposed to really take place. It can take place in the city, but dead bodies need to be buried outside the city walls. So the funeral workers live in the same areas that corpses are supposed to be buried. In other words, outside of the palmarium, the kind of ritual and sacred line of the city that says what is inside the city and outside of it. And so the funeral workers live outside of it. And they have to travel into the city at night, and they wear a red cap, usually, to signify that they are coming in to collect dead bodies within the streets, or perhaps in somebody's house. They have gotten a message that somebody has died. They take the bodies, and they load them on to biers that are going to be transporting bodies. And if you have enough money, you can pay for one on your own.
Wait a minute. I got to stop you here. You said biers.
Right, B-I-E-R, not the Milwaukee beer that you and I enjoy. These are different kind, but they are essentially usually wooden slabs that people are taken out on, they are then taken to the Grove of Libitina. The Grove of Libitina is the goddess of death, and their body is prepared by various people. Now, in the first and early second centuries, the kind of popular method for getting rid of a body was to have incineration, to put a body on a pyre, a P-Y-R-E, and to burn them in cremation, and then to place their ashes in a cinerary urn. But in the second century CE, there begins to be a transition in the preference for bodies from incineration to inhumation, that is to say, burying a body whole. And this is traditionally what the Jews did throughout their history, was to bury bodies whole and in a grave.
Was this what the Christians started doing around this period of time? Because the Christian church is now growing, and we often hear a great deal of talk about the Christian catacombs, where Christians were buried, and they're sometimes secretive. And it's actually one of the ways we figure out that Christianity was growing, because you start to see on these tombs or catacombs names that are associated with Christianity as compared to more pagan names.
Sure. I mean, I want to emphasize that the shift from cremation to inhumation did not happen because of Christianity, but okay. Christianity is responsible for prolonging the trend.
I see.
So Christianity, for sure, is taking on a lot of the same beliefs about the body and corpses that Judaism holds, and burying their dead without desecrating the body through burning it. Jews had been burying their dead in outside the city of Rome in underground areas and underground crypts for centuries by this point. But as Christians within the city of Rome, and we think that probably there was a population of about 8,000 Jews in the city of Rome in the first century, that many of the early population of Christians at this time are being pulled from those Jews, and that they, too, are beginning to bury their dead in ad catacumbas, that is to say, in the hollows. And catacombs doesn't come around regularly as a term until later on, but it means essentially to bury your dead in the tufa rock that's underneath the city of Rome. That's a kind of a softer rock that can be carved out into burial spaces very easily, sometimes two, three, or four on top of each other.
Wow.
And then, inscriptions go in between each of these, but there has to be someone to do that, somebody to actually carve out the tufa rock.
Well, what is the reason people start to bury as compared to burn? You mentioned that the Christians weren't responsible for this. The Jews had been doing it for a long time, but Christians prolonged it. But what's prompting people to go the bury route instead of the burning route?
We don't fully know, but it's based on fashion. I mean, just like there are shifts in pottery fashions and fashions for clothing, there are also shifts in burial trends. Say, mausoleums become more popular at one time, as opposed to hypogea that become very popular. I mean, funeral epitaphs and funeral monuments go through fashion trends just like anything else in society. And so previously inhumation had been popular centuries before, and then cremation had become more popular and cheaper in some cases, and now inhumation was starting to become more popular again. And we don't have really any full evidence for why this happens. It's not a gigantic religious shift among the quote-unquote pagans. It's just that things are beginning to become more or less in vogue at this time, and inhumation comes into vogue in the second century, and the growth of Christianity helps to really sustain this mode of burial for a long time to come.
Now, one of the things that you were talking about a bit earlier was about how these funeral workers or grave diggers or buriers were living outside the city, and they would come in and drag people off on these slabs or biers. Very disreputable profession, but it seemed like it was a profession. I assume that they got payment for this. There was some way that they made a livelihood. What about the Christians that you just mentioned? They're kind of burying people underground in the city there. Was their a different type of people or person arising, say, in the 100 or year 200 that were getting payment for this? Or was this more of the Christian church was a charitable mission to do this for people?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of kind of beliefs on what is happening. And I think that each church within the Mediterranean decides how they want to handle it. I mean, there had been a model that had been given to the early Christians from Jesus. Many of the things that are reduplicated within early Christianity are based on the life of Jesus and what Jesus did when he was living and when he died. And so the two most important people, at least to my mind, to help to shape how Christians act towards the dead and the provision of burial to people more generally are Joseph of Arimathea, for sure, and his assistant that bury the body of Jesus, and they rub myrrh and aloe on his body, and then Jesus is inhumed in a tomb that is bought by Joseph of Arimathea, owned by him, and then this body of a criminal, essentially, is still buried, because Jews believed that everybody deserved a burial, no matter what their status was. Now, there could be more high-status burials and lower-status burials, but everybody deserved to have their body inhumed, is the belief of Judaism. And Christianity carries on in that attitude towards bodies, and thus When you get, for instance, in North Africa, we have a source named Tertullian who tells us, you know, when plague breaks out or when there are shipwrecks and bodies come up on the shore, that the church at Carthage goes ahead and still buries everybody. They're congregants, yes, but also provides burials to all people that need them. So the church is very much shaped in the life of Christ, but also still shaped by attitudes from Judaism.
Mm-hmm. So let's now move into the post-Constantine era, when the church gets, again, it doesn't quite get the official state status with the Edict of Milan, but it definitely is moving toward there. There's subsidies for church building, and things start changing with the funeral service industry. What goes on here?
Right. Well, Constantine is big into organization and infrastructure. I mean, you can probably see the best example of this in his building of the city of Constantinople in the east. He wants it to be not surpassing Rome, but to be a Nova Roma, a new Rome that is going to represent a lot of the Christian ideals that he himself is increasingly espousing. He becomes increasingly, in my mind, more Christian as time goes on. And he wants his city to be a reflection, a mirror of Christian ideals. And that means that he is going to organize everything kind of down to very small details. So Constantine begins to decide that he is going to create collegia, that is to say, associations of funeral workers that are taken from workshops, so artisan workshops within the city of Constantinople, and he's going to defray burial costs by giving these people tax deductions and special dispensations in order to carry out burials for the congregants, but also just people that die within the city of Constantinople.
Mm-hmm. Aha, death and taxes. I knew the taxes would come up. Here it is. You mentioned these collegia. One of the terms that you used in your paper was these things called ordines. I'm not very good at pronouncing Latin, so you'll have to forgive me there. Are the ordines like the collegium? Are they somewhat similar to unions or guilds of funeral workers?
Yeah, they're collected together. These people are collected together and kind of given a special status within the church that is hard to say whether it's clerical. I call it paraclerical oftentimes when talking about Constantine, because the idea of clergy is not yet fully solidified as to what that term means, a clericus. But these people are attached to the church, and the bishop is given patronage over top of these collegia, and he has full power to kind of direct them and oversee their burials. The burials are still going on outside the city of Constantinople, but now the bishop has a more direct role in how they are being performed.
Give us an idea of who's all involved in this process. This is one of the things that I found very fascinating about your paper, because, again, I don't think very much about the funeral industry and who's all involved in this. You just think, well, it's somebody with a shovel and, you know, a plot of land to put people in. But it's actually a fairly big network of individuals. So who's, maybe go from top down and tell us, who are these folks that become part of these ordines who attach to the church or part of these guilds?
Sure. I mean, if you think about it, at the very top is Constantine. He could change any of this at any time because he's the emperor. But then you have a bishop who's kind of very much the head of it. Then really at a closer level to the actual mortuary workers, you have decani, and these are funeral workers. This comes from the Latin a decanus, that is to say somebody who is the head over 10 men. And even though it's not always 10 men, this is kind of the name for a leader of a posse, a decanus, but it gets applied to essentially funeral directors.
I don't know a lot of the etymology of these terms or not, but is decani where we get the term deacon from in our modern usage?
It's not. I mean, this is something that is a false cognate that looks very much like it, but actually that comes through a different channel, and it's important that that A pops up in between the C and the E. I thought that too when I first started reading it, but then these are just a different clerical position.
See, I'm learning something all the time. Okay, so you have these decani, these funeral directors. Underneath the bishop, they're the top dogs when it comes to organizing the funeral services, right?
Right, right. Okay. That seems to be the structure. And then after them are the bier carriers, the ones that are usually carrying the corpse on either a kind of regular wooden bier, or you could have a much more elaborate one if you could pay for it. These are actually the ones carrying the corpses outside the city and carrying them in the funeral procession that proceeds from the city out to where the body is going to be buried.
And who else is involved in this stuff?
Well, there are different names depending on where you are.
Okay.
So the people that are responsible for digging out the tufa rock in Rome, in the catacombs, are predominantly called fastores. That is to say, diggers that are going to be interring your body in Rome. In Alexandria, you have groups of people increasingly getting into the healthcare business and also probably burying people called perebolani, people who undertake danger is the literal translation of that in Greek. They are interring people in Alexandria. And then in areas like, say, Ephesus and Aphrodisias, you have people called kopiatai, who are also clerical and are undertaking burials for the churches in these various areas. And it's important to see that Constantine sets a template, a paradigm, with the city of Constantinople that gets reduplicated and imitated in various other parishes and bishoprics within, especially the Eastern Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that struck me in reading your paper was you mentioned mourners that were organized. Apparently the decani said, we need mourners at these things. Was that how these things went? Is that if you didn't have anybody to cry for you, they brought in a dozen or so people just to mourn? What is a mourner?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, this had happened since Roman antiquity. I mean, I think we all have kind of had that odd, not fantasy, but idea of what it would be like to attend our own funeral and how sad it would be if we only had like 5 or 6 people at our funeral.
Yeah.
Size of funerals are indicative of status and wealth and how loud people mourn. And this continues even today in some places within the Mediterranean. How loudly you mourn is often indicative of how great a person you were and how close you were to the people around you. So if you don't have enough mourners and you want people to wail your name and really make a fuss over you in your funeral procession, then why not hire good actors and actresses? Because funerals are theater. They are meant to be for the living and not for the dead, and thus you're putting on a show, a very ostentatious show that sometimes Christians would object to the level of ostentation. But this is something that is throughout almost every culture, that funerals are a display.
Yeah, this prompts me. Maybe I should start organizing some of my students that I have year to year to, you know, make sure that they show up for that eventual day when I pass away.
Yeah. We all give extra credit to our students that attend lectures, right?
Yeah, why not extra credit for the, you know, mourning at my funeral or something like that?
That's right. But, I mean, the size of a crowd matters. The size of a crowd communicates something to people.
So. No, it does, and you're right in how when our colleagues pass along, and you know, I've been at this profession now for, you know, 27 years, and I've seen many colleagues pass along, and you know, there are people that, you know, when they pass away, they have big, huge to-dos at universities for them, and they bring in scholars from all around the world, and other people they just kind of drag out on the bier outside the university grounds and roll them down the hill. I'm afraid that I might be the former, but I'll have to start organizing my students to come together for me. So
that's right.
Okay, so one of the other things you mentioned a few minutes ago was that there were tax exemptions associated with this. And so all these workers, the Decani, the Fessores, the Parabolanis, the mourners and stuff, they, maybe not the mourners, but some of the people who are doing the dirty work, so to speak, the disreputable work, they get tax exemptions because I would imagine that it's difficult to find people to do this work. I mean, if there's a couple different things, you know, do you want to be dragging dead bodies around or do you want to be growing grapes? You know, I probably would choose the growing grapes. They also get exemptions from military service too, right?
Right. I mean, these are incentives mm-hmm. to get them to work in the funeral trade. But I would like to emphasize just a little bit that our ideas of pollution and touching corpses are a little different in early than the beliefs in early Christianity, because touching the dead, interacting with the dead in early Christianity is something that's very different for Romans to view Christians doing.
How so?
I mean, there's much more contact, much less belief in death pollution. That is to say that the corpse is going to somehow pollute you in early Christianity. Christians like to feast around the grave of the dead in the catacombs at Mensa tombs, for instance, and to really interact with the dead on a higher level than had previously happened. So I think that the stigma attached to funeral workers dissipates to a degree in early Christianity simply because death pollution has shifted, it's changed in character so that there's not as much of a stigma attached to the trade. But still, Constantine is taking people out of their workshops, out of their artisan workshops, and giving them new jobs to do to inter people, and that means he has to defray that cost of lost business, that he has to entice them and give them new positions and new tax incentives. The thing is that he got more applications than he expected, let's just say. During the course of the 4th century, increasingly more and more people want to become funeral workers because as the economy of the Roman Empire begins to fluctuate somewhat and to flutter and in some places to really decrease, then we have people clamoring for tax exemptions and clamoring to get out of the military levies that increased during the course of the later 4th century, especially into the 5th.
Yeah.
So people don't want to serve in a military that is not doing so well, and they would much rather bury a dead body than to fight against Visigoths.
Yeah, I can see where that would be an enticement to choose the funeral profession as a career service. Let me now move us into what is going on with this funeral industry that occurs, because this is the meat of your paper, and it's some really fascinating things occurred during this period of time that I hadn't known about. And I think it's pretty fascinating. And after I read it, I go, of course, this makes perfect sense from, you know, my vantage point as a political economist. But tell us a little bit first about the patron-client relationships that develop between the bishops who, you know, underneath Constantine or any other emperor, they're the top dogs that are going to be allocating who gets what job and where they get that job and the tax exemptions and those funeral workers.
Right. So patron-client relationships is a very pivotal part of Roman society since really its beginnings. You can think of it kind of as maybe your relationship with your advisor, maybe, but we don't have a firm parallel to that in American society. But patrons and clients were very closely bonded together. The patron did things for the client and vice versa. It was a quid pro quo relationship. And something very natural that had often happened between elite Romans, let's say senators or local curial council members, and lower-level people, like, say, their freedmen or people that they had helped out and acquired as clients. So when bishops begin to step in and usurp some of the patronage bonds that had previously been held by the local aristocracy, they too have clients. And they are put in charge of funeral workers, and increasingly, especially in cities like Alexandria, there begins to be a very close relationship between funeral workers who are dependent upon the church and upon the bishop continuing to employ them, and the bishop who increasingly needs protection and so begins to turn to funeral workers sometimes in points of need in order to help them and to protect them as kind of a bodyguard or as a gang.
Protection? What do they need protection from? They're clergy. You don't attack a bishop or a priest. Come on.
Ah, but this is the 4th century. Ah. You do attack bishops. It happens quite frequently.
Wow.
And probably the most famous example of this comes to us through a source called the Collectio Avellana, and it is a collection of documents that tell us about a number of things that happened in the 4th and 5th century, but especially the story of Damasus, who is a bishop of Rome, although he is not a bishop at the time when he is trying to acquire the position. He gets together a group of gladiators and charioteers and then fossores, that is to say grave diggers, and he attempts to get the position of Bishop of Rome by force, and he does. He's successful in it. He forms this coup, he gets the position, and then he sends his gangs a couple of days later to find the supporters of his rival and lock them up in Santa Maria Maggiore and to kill them with roof tiles thrown from the top. So, I mean, violence in late antiquity is something that is escalating,
yeah.
something that's becoming increasingly common, unfortunately. But we have to also think about the fact that Romans never had a great degree of policing, local policing. There were local soldiers, for sure, but as soldiers are increasingly being pulled to the frontier zones to fight, and there are not as many active police forces, violence usually fills in into a vacuum when there is no policing.
Yeah, so much for turning the other cheek there, huh? Actually, that's what I had wanted to ask when I was reading through the paper was, you know, what about the local police forces? Couldn't they handle this? But you just provided a great explanation, right? As the empire is facing more and more threats on the frontiers and they got to defend a very, very thinly spread empire, you got to take all the strong dudes and send them out to the frontiers. And this just opens up for criminal behavior. And it makes a lot of sense, I guess, to use your fossores, your grave diggers, as essentially a paramilitary group, because those are probably the strongest dudes around.
They are. They can. They have a pick all day. They're basically, especially in the city of Rome, where they're burying people underground, outside the city in the catacombs. They're probably very strong. They're pretty buff. I mean, they're the people that. I mean, if I went to people in society today, I would probably go to bodybuilders, right? Or I would probably go to like miners in West Virginia to try and get a nice like posse of protective people. But yeah, you want big people, you want people who are strong, and people who are used to wielding a pick.
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting how this starts out first as just being bodyguards, but then quickly devolves into, bodyguard's not doing anything today, I want that bishopric, I think I will go take it, because my fossores are stronger than that other guy's fossores.
Yeah, I mean, we don't think that the opposing candidate had been using fossores, but... we have a good deal of evidence that Damasus would later patronize the catacombs to a high degree and had been focusing on the catacombs kind of in his mind for a while, and then he gets the chance to focus on them a lot more during the course of his term as Bishop of Rome or Pope by that point, if you want to call him, that then during his papacy he focuses on the catacombs a lot. So he doesn't abandon the catacombs and probably by extension the catacomb workers when he becomes Pope. He continues to really focus on this area as very important to establishing his role in the church.
Don't the Roman emperors start to freak out about this a little bit? Because I know being a Roman emperor at this time, is you don't have a long life expectancy. There's all the backstabbing, literally backstabbing, as well as coups and all these things. And all of a sudden you see all these bishops have their paramilitaries running around and toppling this parish and that bishop, et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't the emperor say, whoa, we got to kind of regulate this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's happening everywhere. We're kind of taking a lot of events happening over a course of a number of decades and kind of bringing them all together to look at them. So maybe they seem more frequent, kind of like if we took school shootings and we brought them all together into one study, it would look as though they're happening maybe a little bit more frequently than they actually are, and in more places than they actually are. But I think that, especially in the East, emperors are lasting a lot longer than they are in the West. The West is undergoing a lot more turmoil in terms of the migrations of, quote, barbarian hordes that are coming into the empire, and they're having to fend them off. But there are long-term emperors, especially in the East, people like Theodosius II, who really do try and react to especially the events going on in Alexandria. And he tries to put caps on the number of parabolani that can be within the associations there. He tries to reconfigure the tax exemptions and the land that the bishops are giving to defray the cost of burial of the poor. So especially, I think, Theodosius II and then later on Justinian especially recognize that this is a problem and that it's getting out of hand and that they have to step in and do something. But there's only so much that they can do sitting back in Constantinople.
Oftentimes. Yeah, you got an empire that's kind of crumbling and can be difficult sometimes. One of the other things that you mentioned that occurs in the post-Constantinian era and occurs over several decades, a century or so, is the commercialization of funeral services and the corruption that comes about in selling tombs. Because now there's a lot more Christians, and if they're going to want to be buried, there's only basically so much space, and some of the space is a little bit more valuable than others. So tell us a little bit about what happens with this commercialization of the funeral services in the post-Constantinian era.
Right. Well, I think that Christianity is not above capitalizing on a market that is demanding certain things. And the things that begin to be demanded, especially during the course of the 5th and into the 5th century and really onwards, are not only very nice, special funerals, but increasingly a demand for being buried next to martyrs and saints of the church that had been interred usually earlier on. And so many times the churches often own the burial spaces that many of these martyrs and saints are buried in and begin to sell burial spaces closer to them. This is a phenomenon that is called the cult of the saints, and is something that is particularly well studied by that guy I mentioned earlier, Peter Brown, who is the expert in the cult of the saints. But essentially, it is a belief within Christianity that certain people have a kind of supernatural power and ability to give off healing powers, especially, and so pilgrims will come to these sites and try and touch relics, try and touch the bodies of these saints. But also, when you die, you want to be as close as possible to these saints, and
yeah,
that is an opportunity.
Yeah, maybe their healing powers will do good for you, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't really do a lot for you if you're dead, but it is a mark of status.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know that certain cemeteries have more status than others. So if you look at the burial patterns in late antique cemeteries in particular, they tend to reflect the social hierarchy of the time. The richest people are near to the saint. The poorest people are far away from saints and probably in pauper burials. So it kind of radiates out from the saint who can afford spaces closest to them and who can afford to ante up money to be as close to possible as touching their tomb.
Yeah, I love this part of your work because as a political economist, this is something that we talk about called rent seeking. And essentially what you do in rent seeking is you create access or limited access to some kind of resource, and then you just hold it up for auction to the highest bidder. And you're able to, in many ways, get a higher price for it than what it would go on the regular market. It also creates some very interesting behaviors amongst the church. One of them, I don't know if I should be laughing at this, but it is humorous, is that the church would oftentimes, you know, tell somebody, we'll bury you right next to the saint, and they pay up a high price to have their relative buried there. And then a couple months later, one of the fossories comes and digs them back out, and hey, look, a new available space.
Yeah, that tends to be something that we're seeing, especially in the inscriptions, that there is a clear anxiety among people when they have their epitaphs inscribed that the fossores are going to come back after they've been interred the first time and move them.
Mm-hmm.
Because who's going to know, except for really your family that comes to try and visit your tomb every once in a while, that you've been moved. So a lot of times the inscriptions are indicating at least a fear and anxiety that this is happening. And so they inscribe on there, you know, I paid for this tomb, fossor, do not move me. It's very much speaking to the fossor that is passing their grave as kind of, you know, a warning and a curse in a way. Like, if you move me, you're going to be in trouble. You know, you're damned for this one. If you go back on our contract, essentially, for me to be buried next to X.
Yeah, I'll come back and haunt you or something. Yeah, I that was just amazing to read that and to see how, one, how the church reacts to this is, oh, there's rent-seeking opportunities. We'll just keep burying somebody new there every month and collecting all the revenue. And then, but then people react to this and say, oh, no, we're on to your scheme. In fact, there was an incident, too, that you write about where some people catch on to this extortionary scheme, not necessarily moving bodies, but just paying exorbitant prices to get buried anywhere by this George of Alexandria. What happens to this guy?
Well, George of Alexandria, I have to say that the source that writes about him later on is biased against him because George of Alexandria is an Arian Christian, A-R-I-A-N. The allegations against him are that he sells burial shrouds at a marked up price, that he is extorting people by limiting the number of biers that were there for the dead, and for ordering that only his people could carry out the bodies of the dead. So essentially he exercises a lot of monopolistic behavior. He says that only his group can bury the dead, that only these things can be used, and as the bishop he has kind of the power to do this. But the people of Alexandria, who, by the way, people in Alexandria are very into popular revolt, they are not very happy with this outcome, eventually he falls out of popularity, the mob in 361 takes it actually out on his body, which happens a lot in Roman antiquity, that when you're mad at somebody, you don't just kill them, you really mutilate their body, and he's stuck on a camel, and then it's kind of sent down to the beach, his body is done away with very unceremoniously, because not giving a body a proper burial, as we've seen, is seen as pretty abhorrent, especially to Christians.
Yeah. So inter this, buddy, and you get a little bit of karma coming your way, I guess.
That's right. That's right. Came back to him. He himself did not get a proper funeral. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was somebody else who reacted to this, too. And if you're a devout Christian, you're concerned about the church, and you're looking at all this behavior of mob violence and over where you're going to be buried and extortionary prices, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to write something about this. And who was that guy that wrote about that?
Right. Well, that's Augustine. So Augustine is very influential. Even when he's living, he is very influential on not only the area that he is bishop over. I mean, he not just the area of Hippo that he lives in North Africa, but also he writes letters to many other people and tries to get the word out to other Christians in the area of the Mediterranean of how they should be acting. So, for instance, City of God is not just meant for his local people, it's meant for everybody to read and to understand. And similarly, he writes something that is called On the Care of the Dead. And it is supposed to essentially be telling people, stop with the fervor of the cult of the saints. This is not that big of a deal. Everybody needs to calm down and to really think about funerals as something that you should be undertaking for the family out of piety and not in order to be buried next to a saint. Like, this is a very reactive text.
Yeah, and this I can imagine would have a huge impact because everybody wants to be within a few feet of a saint or a special relic. And he says, listen, it doesn't matter where you're buried. You just have to be buried well and worry about your salvation and all that stuff. And that takes away the rent-seeking powers of a lot of these bishops. They say, oh, I can't charge higher prices because it doesn't matter where you're buried. I can imagine that he wasn't pretty well received by some of these bishops who were getting some pretty high prices for these spots.
I don't think so, and I don't, I mean, in my opinion, I don't think Augustine's super successful in this. It's kind of like telling people not to have ostentatious funerals or not to wear ostentatious jewelry. It doesn't really stop people from buying Louis Vuitton bags. It really doesn't stop people from buying McMansions. It's just coming out as the church's line, at least in Augustine's belief, that luxury and that fervor over individuals that are not Jesus and not God and not the Holy Father, you shouldn't be focusing on other things when you could be focusing on them.
Yeah, kind of like George Clooney telling me not to drive so many fancy cars or something.
I know.
Yeah. Well, this has been all very fascinating, and I want to close up here in the few minutes we have remaining by asking you a question that I often ask of many of my guests, and that is a big reflection. And is there anything that you've been studying this for many years now, and is there anything that you take away that helps to inform us or inform yourself about how we live our lives today? I mean, this was, I don't know, this might be kind of a stretch, but you're a historian and you love looking at the you know, ancient history and deep history, and you can't help but reflect upon what this tells us about who we are as humans today. So what are your thoughts there?
Well, I'm teaching a class called Postmortem right now, which is on attitudes towards death from antiquity to the Middle Ages. And I just really think that the funeral trade in general is oftentimes a reflection of our own priorities in life, our own beliefs. I think it's a prism. Like many other institutions, we can look to the funeral trade as something that can tell us a lot about ourselves, about the living, about the things that we prioritize in life and the things that we want, by how we not only what our funeral looks like, but also how we treat the funeral workers, whether we're treating them better, whether we're treating them worse. It's oftentimes just more reflective of religious beliefs about the dead and our proximity to the dead. I think that funeral workers today are pretty well treated, and we don't think about it very much, but we still largely prefer these people to be invisible. And we prefer our funeral homes to look like homes. They're supposed to be comforting and give us the least anxiety as possible, and very quiet and something that we don't want to interact with. It used to be that we went to cemeteries and interacted with the dead on a regular basis. There was never a time that you didn't think about the deceased. But in American society today, we have a distance away from the dead that I think Romans and early Christians would find very, very different than what they had. So I think, you know, funeral trades can tell us a lot about ourselves.
And that goes along very well with your work about disreputable professions and the things that, and the other professions that you had mentioned earlier in the podcast. And so we'll just kind of ask you, when is that book coming out? Because that sounds really fascinating. Not only the stuff about the funeral workers, but all these other different professions. How's that coming along?
It's coming along well. I mean, I think the first iteration of the manuscript as a whole will go out to readers next semester. So hopefully within the next year and a half or so, we'll see it hit the shelves. And I'm excited about it. And I think that what's going to be revealed is that these people are human. These funeral workers, these tanners, these bakers, these mint workers, all of the people in the book are oftentimes misunderstood people, but they lived lives that were very regular, and they themselves didn't see themselves as polluted in the same way that if you asked a heretic if they thought that they were a heretic, they would probably say no.
Well, that is a book that I definitely will be looking forward to, and when it does come out, we'll make sure that our listeners are aware of it. And in the meantime, I want to thank Sarah Bond for being our guest on Research on Religion.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.